Welcome, everybody, to The Rad Life, the only talk radio show that takes you along with host and age explorer Rod Gontos on his continuing journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older. The Rad Life is brought to you this week by Your Home for a Lifetime, a company dedicated to empowering you to stay safely, independently, and comfortably in your own home. And now here is your host, Rad Gontos.
Good afternoon, Paul.
What's this getting older stuff? I'm not getting older.
I'm sorry. Were you having a conversation with yourself before we walked
in? I'm listening to the intro there about the great things about getting older. I'm not getting older. I don't know about you, but I'm not doing it.
Don't you filter these ads? Don't you like screen people? Do you just put anybody on here that pays?
So,
how was your 4th of July?
It was very good. My grandson. Ooh, I have a grandson.
You're getting older.
He's getting older. I'm staying the same. So it's Peter Pan. Someday he'll catch up to me, and then we can both play all day long here. We will both be six. We went to see fireworks. It was his first real year recognizing them. He was pretty amazed.
Very cool. And you went, where did you go?
Ladera. We lived near
Ladera. How was the show at
Ladera? Always fantastic.
Where do they have it?
They have a big park out there. We go up the hill overlooking it, so we don't go down with the crowd. We can watch it. So,
hey, so you guys are Highlanders. You know, we're more beach folk down in San Clemente.
Beach are nice. I just can't get to those beaches.
Yeah. No, but somebody sent me a picture from a drone saying, hey, come join us on the beach. And I looked at the picture and I said, no way. Look how many people there are. It was a good time. It was nice to be able to take a break away from stuff. So I'm glad you enjoyed it. You know, we were talking before the show, and I want to just kind of touch on this because I think it's an interesting point. My guest today, Kathy McCarroll, who is the president and CEO of Project Access, and we're going to get to your company here in a minute. But you said something, Kathy, that was, I think, nothing is the same, right? I mean, when it comes to getting older, or getting to people that are older, or even society in general, okay, back 30 years ago, what you would consider that segment of the population, that demographic that's older, their attitudes towards certain things may be completely different than people in that age bracket that are coming into their own now, right? And one of the things we were kind of joking around a little bit about was, you know, the 20, 30 years ago, that group would be, you know, very obstinate and say no and all this stuff. And now with the baby boomers coming in there and because of medical allotments, shall we say, you know.
What are you trying to say?
There's a little bit more.
Dope,
yeah, you're pretty much. You know, didn't we talk? Right. We talked about your hash bash last week, right, in Michigan, University of Michigan.
Yes.
I think it's interesting because, I mean, we're talking about cannabis because it's just such a blatant example, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, 1 minute, you know, 30 years ago, no, say no to drugs and all the stickers and, you know, all this and ban that and the war on drugs, which, you know, that really worked, right? And then now it's like, hey, you know, there's this new app that basically is the equivalent of a Google Maps for cannabis stores.
Wow.
You know, that's being advertised on a billboard right in front of Main Beach in Huntington Beach, you know, in Surf City. So it's interesting because with this show, we always talk about how the journey of aging is different, A, for each person, but also, I think, generationally.
Yes.
Okay, and this is a perfect example of that. So there may be, you know, and I'm bringing it around to the topic we're going to talk about here, but, you know, maybe certain attitudes, societal attitudes about certain things and certain issues will also, better or worse, will be adjusting because of the incoming baby boomer generation and into that age bracket. You know, they're retired, kids are out of the house, a lot of them have more time to dedicate to maybe being civically involved and things of that nature that maybe earlier in life were not. So the demands are kind of shifted as well. And I think it's kind of an interesting time, you know, to just kind of explore the possibilities of what that could mean just overall. So I want to just give you a minute here to introduce yourself because, I mean, I don't think I could do your bio justice, honestly. Wow, okay, is all I have to say. But how did you get to be president and CEO of Project Access? I mean, we always ask this question to people who are on the show. Everybody's got their own personal journey. How did you get to be presidency of Project Access?
Well, I am, you know, I'm a liberal, I'm a social worker and by training. And so I graduated from Chapman with my bachelor's in social work and went on to get a master's at University of Houston. My original passion was child abuse and family dysfunction. And how do we impact, I think if you impact the child early, it impacts the rest of their life.
So true.
And you can't be, you really can't help children unless you work with the entire family. So I first started in Child Protective Services, and it was a fascinating roller coaster ride. Just, you know, I'd be investigating child abuse. I would be at hospitals, you know, taking custody of babies and working with parents that are workable or placing children in adoptions. It was never the same day. It was a hospital or an emergency room. But it gave me a really good street knowledge of how people really,
I can only imagine
what they experience.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a paradigm shifting for me, that what the capacity of what can happen to kids and and how important that first 5 years are in a child's life, how they get a, you know, an impression of how safe the world is, it carries through the rest of their life. So I love that part, and I worked for 20 years really in child abuse investigation, for the child abuse investigation teams with the DA's office, on to child abuse prevention, and I was the director of the Child Abuse Prevention Center, and that was my transition into management, and what I loved about that is because now you could create programs that you could grow and serve not just one family, but I was sitting in Anaheim Stadium one day watching a baseball game, and they announced that the attendance was 52,000 people in the stadium, and that year, the Child Abuse Prevention Center served 52,000 people. And I just brought tears to my eyes, like, really?
Yeah.
Because I missed the street social work, but I could see that because of these programs, now more were touched.
Isn't that amazing?
And then Project Access was a culmination of all that experience, because Project Access is very early intervention in the neighborhoods that are struggling with the family, with the community, from birth to seniors, and now you're actually rallying around this population to improve their lives, which has ramifications for the society, for the entire community.
You know, the funny thing about us as a society sometimes is our areas of focus, like we would put so much focus on seniors, right? We put so much focus on animal abuse. We put so much focus on stuff like that. It's really interesting when you look at there is a selectiveness, I think, as a society, of where we kind of green light certain okay to be focused on, and certain things that kind of slip through the cracks a little bit, right? So I'm liking what I'm hearing about the fact that this really is touching people's lives and providing that support mechanism throughout different phases of life, the kids all the way through seniors. I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah. So we have the preschool program. So, or first the mommy and me classes when the kids are born. And if you weren't raised by parents who really had any parent training and really didn't do it well, then you don't know how to do it well.
Right, so how would you know?
How would you know?
Right.
You totally know.
We've had conversations here about Paul, right?
I mean, he's like, what? He's like,
well,
what?
No, you said you didn't have grandparents.
Yes, I was
going to
bring
around.
That up, yeah.
So he didn't have the way to absorb from his own personal experience.
I don't know what it's like to be a grandparent.
Right.
Yeah,
I said
that's very typical of the baby boomers, particularly the middle or older baby boomers like me, because in our era, grandparents died at 60, 65 or whatever, and our parents had delayed having children till after World War II, so they were a little older, and so you saw this gap. I had grandparents, but they died when I was very little, and so for most of my life, really all of my life, I never had that experience. Now, we're in the reverse. We're seeing, we're going to live much longer, we're going to be the longest lived generation in history, and so conceivably, our grandchildren are going to see us for 20 or 30 years or whatever, you know.
Yeah.
If we're going to live into our
90s
or 100.
So how do you learn? See, that's interesting.
How do you learn? I have no experience with grandparents. And I'm not alone. I could say my wife didn't really know her grandparents. Most of my friends didn't know their grandparents. If they did, they knew them very little. And they were very old. So they were 65 or 70, you know.
Is there a grandparents for dummy book? I mean,
that's a new book.
I think instead of mommy and me, it should be grandpa and me
grandpa
classes.
And me. Yeah. That's really a neat idea I had never thought of. I mean,
it's powerful, really.
Don't you find grandparenting comes so much easier than, you know, that's such an easier position to be in, that you don't do the discipline, you just get to play.
Yes, exactly.
Right, you don't have as much of a responsibility on your shoulders.
And it's amazing, because you talk about, I was kidding, getting older, but it makes me feel so much younger. Suddenly I'm two again. Suddenly I'm three again.
Yeah.
And I'm rediscovering the world through his eyes. Everything is amazing. Oh my goodness, Grandpa, look at that. It's a butterfly.
Yeah.
How long have these been going on?
Yeah.
And he just wants to go tell everybody, did you know there's butterflies?
Isn't that precious?
So I think that, yeah, it does make you much younger, and it takes you back to those. It's part of this recycle of life here, this circle back again. But I really do think there should be grandpa and me classes.
We've talked on the show about the interesting parallels between millennials and boomers, including the fact that a millennial is less likely to, or the relationship between a millennial and a Gen Xer, the parent role, is different from a boomer. And you have a generation of boomers that basically is this large population of people with their own very distinct experience, and both on the national level, international level, you know, activity, activism, you know, sit-ins, all of this stuff. And then you got this millennial group as well that has similar traits but has more of a technology savvy approach of how they do it. They're not going to sit in. They're going to basically do a petition online kind of thing. And it's interesting how much of life's lessons from here, from this generation to this generation, could actually be transferred over, and the openness to that receiving, because it's a grandchild to grandparent relationship versus a grandchild to a parent relationship.
Very true. They're much more open,
right?
Especially in the teen years.
And what can you teach them? Like, whether it's life's lessons, skill sets, you know, to your point, support. My wife she works at Cal State Long Beach as a director of admissions for the Graduate School of Education. But her counseling degree is in actually supporting undergraduate students. That's where she started. And a lot of the people that go to school, especially Cal State Long Beach, most of them, I mean, this is a huge cohort every year.
Yeah.
Okay? Most of them, or a lot of them, they may be first generation in their family going to school.
Amazing group. Yeah.
Right? So the support system needed for somebody to shore them up through the years that they're in college so that they can actually successfully complete. Yep. That the demands on their life, if they have an extended family, the demands in their role playing that they're doing in those family structures, a lot, you know, to where it can be structured such a way to allow for this added new responsibility of being a student.
See, that's perfect. The schools are all doing that at the college level. They're recognizing it's a bigger challenge. Let's nurture these kids. What we do at Project Access is we get them into college. So we take those kids that would never go to school, keep them through high school, get the tutors in so they find academia a good experience, so they're likely to stay, because their parents may not even speak the language. So how do you help with homework? So they do better in school, and then what we do is take field trips to the colleges and show them if you're first generation, I was, my parents didn't go to college, and they didn't know how to help
me. There's no reference point.
How do you do a personal statement? Right. How do you apply, do the SATs and all that? It's a complicated process.
Right.
So we do that for the kids in the Family Resource Center on site in the low-income housing.
So here's the interesting, Kathy. I think a lot of people that are listening to the show right now, they're going, well, yeah, you know, this is normal. So what's the big deal, right? But I think, take a minute, because I think it's important to describe what is exactly Project Access. Who is the focus of your
and some history.
Yeah. Give it a little history. Yeah.
Yeah, started in 1999. Amazingly great concept and very unique. Rather than build a social service agency that people can get in their car, drive over, and go to for help, we live with the people. It's kind of that grassroots social work from the beginning of the social movement in Chicago. Is what we do is we partner with the owners and the builders, and they give us space on site that they pay for that space for us. And it's the community center, or it's the leasing office, or it's two apartments that they've reserved just for our programming. Mm-hmm. We bring the program on site based on who lives in that complex. So senior centers that are all seniors, we design a program just for them. Or big complexes may have 900 units, which five people a unit, that's a small city. Mm-hmm. And we do programming from birth all the way through the senior population. All of them are low income. All of it's affordable housing. All of it's, our seniors are all fixed incomes, and they're just getting together and making it work in affordable housing complexes. So there's a myriad of social services that they need, especially for the younger population, to get them out of poverty. The seniors is to age in place so they're not having to go into extended care.
Which is extremely expensive.
Everyone wants that.
Right.
And for their own life.
Regardless of your income level, actually.
Exactly.
Especially when you're a senior.
I mean, I think this kind of services could be provided for very high income, isolated seniors. Everybody gets lonely, and lonely leads to depression.
Shut-ins, isolation,
Yeah, and
abuse.
Doesn't matter how much income you have.
Right.
You have to have someone pulling you out and putting you in a group of others.
You know, we started the show probably about over a year ago now, and our first guest was actually Casey Kasem's daughter,
Carrie. Oh, really?
and we talked about elder abuse. And I don't know that people at that first show realized, but I didn't realize, I was just getting involved with that organization, and you know, that this was not an isolated case. Not only was it not an isolated case, it was an underreported situation.
Yes.
And money, wealth, income level, socioeconomic, none of that really mattered.
Mm-mm.
That person was still a vulnerable population and was victimized through abuse. And it really came down to isolation.
Yeah, not having your support.
That was the common thread in every single one of those cases.
Yeah. And so much so that there's elder abuse registries in every county and all through the United States. And now we are having less children. The baby boomers have way less children. Mm-hmm. I grew up with four. I have one.
Mm-hmm.
So how much easier to be isolated in the senior years?
Right. Very easy. Unless there's another way to manage that or address that. And again, depending on your mental and depending on your health levels, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all solution.
Yes, however, building community around them is.
Exactly.
So whether that's the retirement, you know, Sun City,
right,
or it's in low-income populations, which are less likely to have kids there,
right,
to support them, we just rally, Project X just rallies it all right there where they live.
Well, and I think, if I may, I think community here really is more a sense of belongingness,
yes,
than actually four walls and a roof.
Absolutely.
It's really that. It's a sense of being part of a bigger support network, if you will, right?
Yeah.
So let me ask you this, because we live in Orange County, right? And Orange County real estate is a very expensive thing.
Yes.
So how, because you know, I live in South County, and I'm ashamed to say, but it almost seems like every time somebody utters the words, you know, under their breath, quietly in the shadows, you know, affordable housing, you know, the reaction to that is negative. The reaction to that is, oh, no, the neighborhood's value, property is going down,
it's those people.
And then, you know, I hate the word NIMBYs. Actually, I refuse to say NIMBYs, not in my own backyard, right? Basically, how do we deal with that? How do you face that? Is it limited geographically to certain places? How do you dispel the myth? You and I know that that is not the truth, right? But it seems to be a very easy place for people to go. Out of fear, out of lack of knowledge, non-information, nobody's really taking a leadership role maybe in the community to educate the community about the fact that, well, maybe there's some not facts here. Let me give you the fact versus the myths.
Yeah, and I read more about, you know, the issues you brought up in San Clemente, the city council, you know, the resistance of the neighborhoods. However, I can tell you, my experience with it, these housing complexes, affordable housing, are done extremely well. We're out of the days of the tenement housing where it was decrepit and not taken care of by the city and people were stacked up tall. That's history.
Yeah.
The affordable housing developers.
The projects. Yeah.
They're beautiful, the places. They're rehabs. There's one right next to Disneyland where a lot of the Disneyland entry-level workers work.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. It's been rehabbed by funders that pull together money from all different sources, and then they rehab them, and it's a really nice living community. And then you bring in social services to address the gang population prevention, graffiti, all of that kind of stuff. Your turnover doesn't happen, and you've got your working poor living in the community being supported and raising the next generation to get out of the poverty. Like, we just went out to Cota de Casa Golf Tournament. They're going to have a tournament that they're going to use the funds to support Project Access. And as I was presenting to them, I said, yeah, well, the funds we've raised are going to be used for the affordable housing complex in Mission Viejo right down the street from you. And they all went, there's affordable housing in Mission Viejo? And I said, yeah, and I'll take you guys over there. It's a beautiful apartment complex. It's just that the families living there are the working poor and qualify for discounted rent while they're educating their kids.
Why don't you talk about it a little bit more, Kathy? Like, what is the qualification?
You know, it's difficult to quantify quickly because it depends
on... And who are the working poor? That's a definition that you don't hear very often.
Like
By definition, can you be poor and working? I guess so here.
Yeah, I mean, you're minimum wage employees. Like, we have a hospitality industry in Orange County that's huge, working poor. So Disneyland has all the, in our complex, about 75% work at Disneyland as the entry level. Mm-hmm. They work in the hotels as the maids. Mm-hmm. What an incredibly hard job.
Mm-hmm.
My hat's out to them. And my hardest job in my whole life, I have to say, was waitressing, getting through college waitressing.
Mm-hmm.
That's your waitresses and your maids and your
and your service stuff.
Service workers, mm-hmm. very low income, bare bones, mm-hmm. and living in even affordable housing keeps them going. But what they tell me is, we're doing this for our kids. We want you in here because we want you to teach our kids how to get to college and not have to work as hard mm-hmm. as we do. So the population of affordable housing that we serve is that population in adults through children. Then the senior population are fixed income. What I have found in our properties, a lot of war immigrants. They're mm-hmm. all documented legal citizens here, but they have been through wars in China, mm-hmm. in Vietnam, in Korea. In our populations come from the Middle East, from Mexico, from mm-hmm. El Salvador, and they've all, now they're in, and we have a complex that the average age is 82, mm-hmm. and they're so healthy. It's just amazing. It's mm-hmm. just, we have community gardens, we have, you know, if nurses...
How do you address the diversity?
You know what is interesting? The senior populations tend to live, the entire complex is all Korean, or the entire complex is Vietnamese.
Instinctive support system.
Yeah, just language and that. They have bilingual.
Commonalities. Yeah.
It's just natural. It's what we do. We're in our other complexes, some are mixed, where there's young families, so we have programs where there's little kids in the preschool, and then seniors in part, so we link them up together, just the grandmother or grandfather complex that really is really healing. And then we have complexes in San Jose that are huge bastions of gang activity. It's a hot spot in, designated by the city, and we're doing gang prevention. And we're doing. It's so dangerous, the elementary school kids can't walk to school, so the teachers come over to our Family Resource Center, pick up the kids, and walk them to school and back.
Wow.
And they do all their parent-teacher conferences at our center. It's a partnership with the school district.
Can I ask you a question? We had somebody on, I don't know if it was Rod's show or one of the other shows we did, but they're talking about alternative community structures. When I was a kid in the Midwest, I grew up in very isolated communities. The old people lived here, the poor people lived here, the rich people lived here, and there was no integration of, not racially, not culturally, certainly not economically here.
One side of the track or the other.
Yeah, everybody, if you were a certain group, you lived there. If you were a certain group, you lived here, and the two never mixed or cross paths. When I first came to L.A., I saw the remnant of that in downtown L.A., where you had the wealthier people lived in the city, and then across the rivers, what eventually became the freeways, the 5 freeway and the 10 freeway, up in Boyle Heights and other places, where the service workers lived, mm-hmm. and they would come down, work in the affluent area, and then go home at night over the bridges, over the rivers. Mm-hmm. What I loved about California is that it didn't seem to have that model. And in fact, places like Irvine welcome diversity. The idea that you could stay in your whole life cycle. You could live in an apartment, move to your own condo, townhome, get a house as big as you can afford, and then eventually end up in senior living and stay all within that community, that cycle of life. Are we going away from that? Is there a movement? We were talking about back east, where some people are trying to say maybe it's good to have seniors and kids together because the seniors can sort of watch out and be the
you're
neighborhood
about, like,
watch.
The care, daycare kind of and senior center combination that some people are doing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Where you suddenly give new purpose to the seniors, and they can pass on, and kids grow up meeting seniors.
It used to be mentorship by the elders in the village, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very human instinct, I think.
Right, but we've gone away from that, where for a long time the seniors were isolated.
We love to compartmentalize in this country. Mm-hmm. You know, we love to put everything in a neat little box and put it on the shelf and label the shelf.
Right.
Life isn't that, I don't think life is that clean cut, especially when you have multi-generational families. I mean, a lot of the new housing in Irvine is actually geared to old multi.
Especially Chinese communities and stuff, where they relish that and look for that. I never grew up around older people. They, you know, again, they died by the time I came along, or they were isolated and sent somewhere. They moved to Florida or someplace else. Are we going back? Which way are we going? Are we heading more towards integrating different generations, or are we still isolating and separating everybody?
I don't know that there can be an overall.
I don't know if there's a trend line one way or the other.
Yeah, it depends on where. I think different states have different trends. I think that's what, with the city saying, you can build this housing development, but 20% is to be affordable housing in the cities. The permits, that actually naturally does some of that. I mean, it's an actually good solution.
But the community's fight, Yorba Belinda, didn't they recall a bunch of city council members because they dared to try and comply with that requirement and approve affordable housing in Yorba Belinda, and they were actually recalled and almost kicked off?
Kathy, that's the ideal, right? The ideal is, yes, you're going to do a development that a certain percentage is designated affordable housing, okay?
Right.
That's the ideal. I don't know, and I'm asking the question, What is the reality? How often is that actually something that is accomplished? How often is it that there's so much time and energy and resources put towards, you know, don't tell me what to do? I don't know. But it seems to me that in either case, we are lacking for in affordable housing, mm-hmm. especially in certain areas where maybe affluent real estate or prices of real estate is so high that the push is, I mean, I was reading a story about properties that were motels and things of that nature that were short-term stay in certain places that are being obliterated for, you know, mixed use and condos. There's mm-hmm. a loss of that kind of affordable housing in certain communities because the interest
whether you liked
in,
it or not,
is
it,
in more,
it filled
in,
some function,
in more yeah. profitable housing
yeah.
development. So what has been your experience with that? I mean, is it something that a lot of people embrace? Is there a lot of pushback against it? Or is there a lot of energy used to not comply with it? What's been your experience?
My experience is because I was started social work in the days when it was all segmented tenement project housing. It clearly didn't work. And the trend of doing the 20% requirement by the cities, and they have to require it, or it won't be done. And you're going to get pushed back, but you got to, you know, it's the law. So it's the policy. So you're always going to have that, but it works.
Is that a state law or federal law?
You know, I don't know. I don't want
to. Because they have to do it to qualify for some funding from somebody. Yeah. I don't know if it's from the state or the feds, but
yeah, or is it city policy? Is it county policy? Is it state? There has to be some mandate somewhere. You know, it probably wouldn't be happening.
I mean, I've heard of things like in lieu of fees and the money yeah. basically goes instead of the project actually having affordable housing on that particular property, that money goes into the city. And the idea is that now the city would be responsible for building affordable housing in lieu of the ones that were supposed to be in that mm-hmm. development.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's different in every city.
And that doesn't get done usually because now mm-hmm. it's more subject to public outcry or pushback or whatever, and it's more of an elected position. It's kind of an interesting thing. All I know is it seems to me that having that diversity in any community adds strength and mm-hmm. not weakness. Mm-hmm. Okay, but then that's how I see through that filter. Okay,
right. Mm-hmm.
And that we actually have a lack of it. And it's not just, to your point, it's not just families that maybe, you know, immigrant families with a lot of kids and their families and everybody's living in under one, you know, one bedroom thing. There's also seniors. There's also other vulnerable populations
veterans,
that could benefit veterans, yeah. you know, from affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's tax incentives for the builders to build affordable housing in order to increase.
Interesting.
I was going to ask, you know, who would want to take on that task? Because what's the average acre of land? Is like $2 or $3 million. It's something crazy. We had the Building Industry Association in here the other day. I think an acre is like $3 million, just an acre of land. And then you break that up into how many units you can put onto an acre. Who would want to take that investment? And your return is what? Affordable housing with limited upside to it?
Well, but remember, property values increase in California no matter what. And so you buy this, you know, 350 unit
and you
apartment
improve
complex.
It.
Yeah, and you get a tax credit for it. Then you improve it, and mm-hmm. then you hold it, and then you sell it. And the retention rate of your population is so much higher when social services like Project Access that
leave
a property 10 years. There's mm-hmm. like a 95% occupancy rate.
Wow.
So
mm-hmm.
then when you go to resell, the new buyer looks at that and there is profit to be made, and it should be. I mm-hmm. mean, it is a.
But then did they take it and kick all those people out like Rod's saying, and then turn it into high rise?
No, it can't be. And it's zoned for that. It's owned.
So it stays that way.
And well, unless you have a change of zoning, whatever. But the point to Kathy's point, I think, is the initial reaction, like you understandably had, is,
right.
Oh, it's affordable housing. There's no money to be made in this spot. No, it's not true at all. You're taking a property, you're developing it, you're improving
it's
it.
Real
you
estate.
It's real estate development, mm-hmm. right? It may not be the same kind of return, maybe, and as fast a quick appear at the time where you're building, you're filling, you're flipping.
Mm-hmm.
This may be more of a longer investment strategy, but you also have a more stable population, and if you have services mm-hmm. built into that, then a lot of them. And we finally did get one actually built right in downtown area,
in terms of San Clemente.
Oh, yeah.
right.
I'm not
brand new. It's on Sarah, and it's Spanish Revival, three story. nice little clusters, you know, fits into the environment, you know, but oh my gosh, you know, the number of years and energy spent to get that dang thing built. And at the end of the day, you know, and it was everything but the, and the, including the kitchen sink.
Sure.
Too many cars are going to be parked there. Too many people are going to be living there. Too many, you know, the sky is falling, Chicken Little running down
and
through
the wrong kind.
Right. So it's amazing. It
and
really
it's
is
going to bring
amazing.
Down all the property values.
Who do you work with, Kathy, like in a situation, like what is a typical situation, like where you're starting a new project or or somebody is considering building something?
Let's hold that.
Right,
and go to
but
break.
I want to ask the question, and then we'll come back. And then, you know, how early do you guys get involved?
So the builders bring us in. They invite us into their property. So we work with about 8 builders right now, builders and owners. When they're applying for funding, say from a municipality, and they have to do an application, it's competitive bid. They get extra points on their application to say, we're not just going to build housing.
You're actually bringing project access.
The counties know.
Brilliant.
The counties know. That's added value. It's similar with the veteran housing. When you have severely disabled veterans, you don't just give them a house. You just round them, you know, wrap around them.
Yeah, here's your keys. Get in there. See you later.
You got your house. Yay.
Yeah.
No, they're struggling. They need all those services.
Yeah.
So the counties then, they have more likely that they're going to get the bid. And so then they have to partner with us, and it's a commitment of 15 years.
Okay. We're going to go to a break, but I want to tell everybody to go while we're on break, and then when you come back, maybe you can also check this out as well. I'm going to give out your website.
Cool.
It's project-access.org.
Yes.
If anybody's listening and you have any questions for Kathy or myself or Paul, or you want to share any of your own personal stories, if you've been a person that's benefited from a property where Project Access has been, I'd love to hear from you. And our telephone number here is 949-330-7761. And you can always listen to us live, too, by going to octalkradio.net and clicking the big Listen Live button. We'll be right back.
He used to pester me for a walk. Now, it's the other way around. Hoag's physicians perform more orthopedic procedures than any other hospital in Orange County. Our orthopedic program, in fact, ranks among the top 5 in the entire country. So whatever it is you live for, you can get back to it sooner. Because as it turns out, the best part of life is simply living it. Hoag for Life. Visit us at www.hoag.org.
If you are like the majority of Americans, you want to continue living in a familiar environment throughout your maturing years. In fact, according to many surveys, 82% of homeowners overwhelmingly prefer to age in place, which means living in their current homes safely, independently, and comfortably, regardless of age or ability level. With over 30 years of combined experience in residential, commercial, hospitality, and destination resorts fields, Your Home for a Lifetime is a company dedicated to empowering you to maintain your quality of life and independence by helping you make your house your home for a lifetime. Do you want to reorganize or remodel your home? Do you want to add a full bathroom and possibly a bedroom on the main floor? Are you looking to make your kitchen more functional? Is an aging parent moving in, or your child is moving out, or even moving back in? Call Your Home for a Lifetime at 949-492-1872 or check them out on the web at yourhomeforalifetime.com and find out how they can help you make your house your home for a lifetime.
Okay, we're back. If you weren't joining us before, you joined us near the end of the show. My guest today is Kathy McCarroll, and she is the president and CEO of Project Access. It's a nonprofit that operates 55 family resource centers located within affordable housing complexes in California, Colorado, Georgia, and Arizona. And they provide families with the tools needed to break the cycle of poverty, become healthier, further educated and financially stable. Project Access program served over 13,000 low-income children, youth, and seniors in 2015. When we were going to the break, I asked Kathy, you know, we were talking about developments and, you know, affordable housing, and how early do they get involved, how early does Project Access get involved, and who do they get involved with? And I think you had just answered that, you know, there's certain builders that actually approach you guys, and when they're submitting a proposal or answering an RFP or something for the city, they basically add you as part of their submission, which actually makes perfect sense, because not only are they saying we will comply with the affordable housing component, but we also understand and recognize that the people that will be in this complex may need a little, not a handout, but a hand up in certain services that we will also provide space for those services to be housed in.
Yeah.
And I asked you during the break, and I think I'd like to start with this, is I know you guys do new projects, like you get involved with projects as they're starting, and then ones that where they're basically being repositioned, okay? What are you looking for in that space? What services are provided?
Sure, yeah. It's all-encompassing. And one of the things we require is a computer lab. So right away in one of our rooms, we'll set up a computer lab, and that impacts amazingly. A lot of our families don't have computers at home, yet the schools are all computerized. Mm-hmm. So the kids come in 6 a.m. to do their homework, and they work off the computers for all their research and their training, as well as learning how to navigate the computer world. If you don't, you're really not set up for success in the job force. And they're used for the adults to come and look for jobs, to write resumes. We have a scanner. We have a printer. We can send it out to them. We can walk them through how to write it, how to perfect it.
Seniors that are not maybe accustomed to using certain technology need a little hand in that too.
Yeah, so we have to laugh. Like we teach classes on how to use the cell phone because it's like a newfangled thing. And we have these 82-year-olds that really do want to communicate, need to communicate with their kids, but don't understand this texting.
Well, we talked about isolation, and we talked about that. You know, technology is a big like things like Skype, things like that.
Yes.
Actually, especially when we are such a transient nation, where people may have, you know, remnants of their family on the East Coast, but they're basically find themselves now on the West Coast, and they're at the point. Yeah, it's actually kind of a funny personal story. My mom and dad live about 6 miles away from me. My sister and her family about 3 miles. So we don't, we're not under one roof, but we're pretty close, right, in town. And there's a routine with my parents where, you know, on every Friday, they will go do their grocery shopping. And so it used to be I would get a call. Okay, started off on my landline, then it became on my cell phone, right? And my mom would say, you know, basically, oh, we're going to, you know, it's really funny. It's like almost like clockwork on Friday, about like 8 o'clock or 8:30. We're going to be going to the grocery store, you know, like every other Friday. And, you know, so what would you guys like for groceries? So I get a little grocery delivery every Friday,
really?
which is a way for the family to continue to connect.
I love it.
Right? We have lunch on Sundays. But this is just sort of this real life routine kind of thing,
it. And
right?
And they love routine.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, and then, you know, my mom may have read a couple of things in the newspaper. She's cut them out and highlighted them, so she drops those off with the groceries. So there is a payment that comes with that, you know.
You have to listen.
I don't have to listen. I have to read and report back. But basically, you know, you want the groceries? Here's some articles you should read, right?
Yeah.
But it was really an interesting moment when all of a sudden I didn't get a call anymore. What I got was a text. Because mom upgraded to an iPhone. Right? And so it was really interesting because, you know, technology, we laugh at technology and we talk about it as being, you know, oh, you know, it's common. You know, doesn't everybody do this?
Yeah.
It's not the case if you're not accustomed to it. You know, I remember my father when he stopped working. You know, when he was working, he had like 4 or 5 people working for him. Right? When he stopped working and he had to basically do some follow-up or something, you know, now from a retiree, kind of transitioning out, he had to learn how to use a word processor.
Yeah, yes. He had to learn to do it.
Right? What do you mean I typed this? How do I format this, right?
Can I ask you a question?
And those are things, just kids need them.
Yes.
People that maybe job skills did not, you know, if they were maybe in manual labor skills, and then basically now they're trying to transition and upgrade their skills.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask you a question about your mom's routine?
Sure.
Does she also bring the cannabis over?
No, that's your mom. No, but that's a cultural thing, I think. Yeah. Had she spent time in upstate New York, I'm sure the cannabis would be the
I'm just saying,
well.
You're saying seniors are transitioning, that they're now largest consumers of cannabis, and, you know.
But I had a very funny story last week where somebody, it was 4th of July, and it was like somebody's like, because we had some hookahs. I had gone to a friend of mine, and I had some hookahs. And so, of course, you know, everybody looks very suspiciously at the hookahs, and they're like,
What's
the flavor? And like, you know, I don't know. They're like, well, so I said, do you smoke? He says, no, I usually like my brownies in a tray. Right?
Wow.
So again, you know, what we're talking about is the world is changing.
Yeah.
How you address it is changing, right? Our takes on things are changing, right? this is actually, I'm sort of positive about this thing where, you know, we have people in our community that are not affluent. We live in part of the country which is, and yet we still have to address, you know, it's like, you know, I am my brother's keeper. You have to also basically provide services, civic responsibility as a citizen to basically see. And I'm not talking about handing the person, you know, money to go buy alcohol, right? I'm talking about providing services like this, mm-hmm. having a safe place for those kids to actually do their homework at 6 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing, too. You know, the assumption is, oh, you know, doesn't everybody have a home over their head and a table they could do their homework in? Not necessarily.
You had that one gentleman on who was Hispanic, and he lived in a, as he said, kind of a tough neighborhood.
Yeah.
And his son was here. And he said, you know, part of the problem we have is that the kids in his neighborhood don't have their own room or don't have their own desk. Mm-hmm. They have no place to do the homework other than in the living room where there's
they
lots of people and lots of things going on.
They may not have a family dynamic that understands the importance of doing the homework.
Or a place to go do. I said,
right.
First thing my parents did when I went to high school is they bought me a desk for my room. They said, that's where you're going to go up. And I'm like, what am I going to do with a desk? I'm not 50. I'm not going to work. But it created that notion. This was your workspace, your workplace, and it would be quiet, and it would be away from anything, and you had to go up there, even if you weren't doing something, and look mm-hmm. like you were doing something. And I think that's true. In a lot of these households, there's 10, 12, a lot of people jammed into a house. There may not be any place quiet to go do something.
This is veering a little bit off, but I will tell you, I had a very, very, very positive experience, and it was one of those very pleasant surprises that life hands you every once in a while. I went to an event that was just a book signing, a couple of authors talking. One of them is a friend of mine who we've also had on the show, Tanya Brown, Nicole Brown Simpson's mm-hmm. sister. And she brought a gentleman with her that was also an author. Turns out to be the guy who actually started the Make-A-Wish Foundation.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And we're sitting in a very intimate situation. There's probably about 20 people in the room, you know, and he's sitting in a chair, and he's telling a story about Make-A-Wish Foundation, which, by the way, there's a book called Wishman coming out, and there's also a script that was written based on that, and he'll be on the show. He did say he would be on the show with me. He'll call in from Arizona, from Prescott. But they're making a movie out of it.
Hmm.
That is now a major picture with like a $40 million budget or something. The thing about it that was very fascinating is here's a person who was, you know, he was in the military, he was a policeman. I don't know if you know about the story.
No.
The guy, okay, he was a motorcycle cop. The whole thing about being a motorcycle cop, and then, you know, this kid basically wanted to be a motorcycle cop, and he had like 2 weeks to live, and, you know, because of Chips was on TV, and it was a popular show, and da-da-da. Very happenstance. This person finds himself now basically living through the experience of providing the final wish for a child
mm-hmm.
that then becomes the catalyst for forming a foundation that has over 63 offices worldwide, or 33 offices worldwide and 63 offices in the United States. I mean, how life unfolds if you are
yeah.
open to it is an amazing
thing. So true.
Amazing,
mm-hmm.
right? So he was, and I might get this wrong, but he was abducted by his mom, away from his dad. They were living in campers. They were living on floors of kitchens of people who would take them in.
This police officer?
Yeah, before when he was a child. At the age of 10, he had a full-time job basically washing dishes.
What?
His mom then abandons him again, and he basically gets, you know, is fortunate to have the mentorship of the person who runs the restaurant, who owns the restaurant, who then
wow.
teaches him give back. You know, he shares the story where he, you know, they had arranged for a room for him in this older lady's home so he can have a place to stay. And, he, you know, he was paying $25 a week for his room, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And this gentleman who he worked for told him, you know, you should always give back when you can. And his reality was, I can't even afford $25 to basically pay for my week's rent. What do you mean give back?
Mm-hmm.
At which point that older gentleman instilled in him the fact, well, you know, so-and-so over there who brings you tortillas, for example, to help you eat, well, you know, they have, you know, see how they're trying to paint the house? So maybe you go give them a hand for painting the house. It's not always about money. It's about
sure.
giving of yourself in certain ways, right?
Yeah.
So it's fascinating because we look at all those members of society that we have in our communities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, as something as simple as that kind of hand up,
mm-hmm.
shapes the lives of people that become such a contributor to their communities.
Well, we've seen that we're in the programs in the complexes so long that we raised the kids. We have one who just went off to Cal State Long Beach to get his degree, first generation, would have never had that kind of exposure.
It wasn't for your programs.
Yeah, because their parents don't know. Mm-hmm. Parents wouldn't know how to help them through it, or really how to walk them through like parents need to at that age. He comes back now and he mentors all the kids in the program. And in their language.
Very
and they
cool.
have their role. We had a family come in from Afghanistan, war-torn Afghanistan. I just got to get my family out of here. They didn't speak English. They mm-hmm. didn't know the culture, the social. Imagine what that's like for children. Mm-hmm. And so they moved into one of our complexes, and the kids came down and said, could you help us? And they got a social group that taught them how school works, and the mother came down and learned English. The father worked 3 jobs, driving a taxi, doing everything he can. And they raised enough money. They saved enough money. It was about 7 years they were with us, and they bought a house in Corona, and we celebrated their move. The whole
that's
got to
be so gratifying.
Oh, it is.
I mean, seriously.
It is. You reminded me of a story you were telling me. I was just down in our San Diego property. It's a beautiful refurnished building right in the heart of Skid Row. And mm-hmm. it's like I went in and went, this is really... And where you live affects your mental health.
Of course.
And it's classy. It's airy. It was just lots of light. Really beautiful. And we moved in there chronic homeless. Chronic. Just had lived down the streets for decades.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the women moved in. She was so touched, she didn't feel like she deserved it. And she actually, every night, when it got dark, she went out and roamed the streets because she felt guilty about having a home. And that took her about 6 months until she just settled in.
She could leave that. She felt like it was okay for her to have that.
Wow. I don't deserve it. And but that's a process with all the surrounding mental health services and the education. I mean, think about these kids coming home from school when their parents work 3 jobs. That's our working poor living near Disneyland. If it was me, I'd come home, I'd eat Doritos and watch TV or play video games, right? My daughter would do that. But now they come down, drop their backpack off in our center, and we have a partnership with the food bank, so they have a healthy snack, because that's important. You can't study until you're not hungry. And then they pull out their homework, and we have tutors from the local universities going over their homework with them every day. What a different outcome.
Mm-hmm.
On site. They're going to do that. And then the parents are going to be like, really? My kids are actually getting that type of huge support academically and physically. I can relax and not worry about them at home in a gang.
Right, because I'm doing those 3 jobs, I'm still very concerned about my kids. What are they being drawn into? Exactly.
I want better for them.
We've had a couple other people on Rod's show, in other words, and they talk about to break the cycle of homelessness or drug addiction or any of these things that just seem to be in. We can't ever seem to break out of these things. One of the things that's needed is you got to start with having some place to live. If you don't have some place to live, how are you going to deal with your drug addiction? If you're constantly worrying about where you're going to be, how do you ever find a job? It sounds so simple, but if you take that off of their worry list, then it opens them to at least be able to explore some of these other things. Any studies, any ideas, any statistics on how this impacts? Because I think the other aspect of this that people don't realize, and we've talked a lot about on this show, yes, it's a good positive thing to do for the community. Yes, it makes it richer, vibrant, all those things. But also, in some sense, doesn't it help save money for the community if people aren't homeless and
smart business
robbing and creating chaos? And
well, one big research, I just went to a seminar and a physician did a really intensive study on who overuses the healthcare to huge amounts of money, huge numbers. And he followed a statewide, I can't remember where it was, I know it was California, I think it was primarily Northern California, and what he did was he tracked the users of the healthcare system among the homeless. Well, the homeless, their health is going to decline, especially aging, and so all they have is the ERs. And so when they got housing, they were able to put the families in housing, which kept them healthier. They used less health care, so there's actually a movement to say, why don't we take Medicare funds and pay for housing for our homeless seniors, because we'll save money in emergency room costs. Because if you're sick at all,
and if you keep kids out of
it's proactive versus reactive.
If you keep kids out of gangs, isn't that going to cut down crime? Isn't that going to cut down
your health? Yes. Our whole health system. I mean, proactive versus reactive.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, one thing one may say that reactive is more the normal state. I disagree. If you don't have the affordability to be reactive, in many cases, in many cultures, in many communities, you do the pre-planning. you make sure you don't get yourself into that position, mm-hmm. right? But if you actually shift focus on that being what is educated, what is encouraged, what is, you know, try to get people to implement a more proactive versus reactive take on things, there is a cost saving.
For sure.
But I think then the counterbalance of that is just push them out of our community over to the other community, and we can close our eyes. We won't have to deal with homelessness. We won't have to deal with crime.
You won't have to, but your children will have to. And that's the thing that I think gets lost all the time. You are not being a good steward of your community if you're just shifting, or country, if you're just shifting the problem or the achieving of a sustainable solution further down the road.
Well, and the lie is that they really do not cross boundaries. For example, drugs. We had the sheriff in here, Sandra Hutchins, and she said, everybody, first question they asked me, in affluent Orange County, is a drug problem. She said, of course it's a drug problem. There's mm-hmm. a drug problem everywhere. Mm-hmm. Small towns, big towns. This idea that it doesn't exist in nice neighborhoods. There is a homeless problem. There is a drug problem. There are mental health problems, and those exist whether or not you want to see them. They're in every community.
Right, but the homeless problem is not returning vets. It's not anybody from the community. They're being bussed in from somewhere else.
Yeah,
okay,
right.
none of us are homeless. None of us have a drug problem.
No,
none of us
kids,
need
right.
an affordable housing versus $800,000 as a starting in housing situation. Mm-hmm. Where is that disconnect?
It's a fairy tale we perpetuate.
What is
on
the bubble? Is it that bad? Is it a human condition? Is it a regional condition? I mean, is it societal? Have we gotten to the point where we're desensitized from this?
I'll bring this up to your guests, and I said this. We had somebody else from the homeless task force in here, and I don't see homelessness in Orange County. This sounds horrible. I live in South Orange County. I work across from South Coast Plaza. I get in my car. I drive down the freeway. I go see the nice master plan community I live in. And I'm sure there's homelessness within that community. I'm sure there's homelessness within walking distance of where I am here. But I either choose not to see it or I don't see it. It's somehow I drive past it. I drive around it. I don't see it. It isn't like in an urban area where I'm stumbling over people on the sidewalk or whatever here. You know what I'm saying? So I think it's easy for me to think that problem doesn't exist here because I don't see it in my day-to-day
existence. Well, if you don't recognize the problem, then you don't think there's anything to be dealt with.
Right. So, if you go ask most people in Orange County, is there a crime problem, is there a homeless problem, is there a drug problem, they're going to say no because I don't see it. Whereas if we were all compacted on top of each other in downtown Los Angeles, for example.
Well, and if they exist, they all exist in an affordable housing situation.
Well, of course.
Yeah. they're all centralized somewhere else.
So do you think that's the case, or am I just exaggerating? Do people not see it and therefore not think there's a need for your services?
Yeah, I think it's based on lack of information, lack of awareness, lack of compassion. And we work in the population and find what a great population to work with. What I like is looking at it systemically. Like, let's start with the children.
Mm-hmm.
And let's empower them. You sit and you listen to the life stories of the people in these scenarios, and you think, holy cow, to whom much is given, much is expected. Because
mm-hmm,
I was
right.
given a lot, and why not any of us in given those life situations?
Yeah.
So it starts with compassion and then rational action. I have to commend the builders of affordable housing. They do compassionate job of it. They do a classy and thoughtful job, and we're it's extra cost to have us there, yet they actually really do care about the people that they
are. You at liberty of sharing any names of any builders or anything like
that?
I would love to get them a little shout out.
I wish I had a list, because they're so fabulous. That KB Homes, the Related Housing. Oh, I'm forgetting. Dan Stanger's Bridge Housing Group, Bridge Investment Group. Oh, and we also work with the property management companies, KBM.
Well, and you have. I mean, I'm just looking at your partnership list.
You're in a tough spot here. Now she's going to get yelled at all the people she forgot.
No, because
it's like an Academy Awards speech.
I just think those people those people that are basically, I understand it's a business and their focus is on that,
mm-hmm.
right? But they have other choices. They could be doing other
sure.
kinds of development, right?
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
so, even though it is a business, it is an important, critical part of the building of our communities. And I think
yes.
they really should get recognized for that as being a positive mm-hmm. thing, not just, you're just a bunch of slumlords building. And it's not.
It's not.
There are people that temporarily or over a longer period of time, and we've identified at least three age brackets. We talked about children that are vulnerable population.
Yes.
We talked about people that are, you know, in their working career lifespan that are basically maybe trying to transition. We had a lot of layoffs. The economy kind of crashed. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are just on that edge of being that
yes.
vulnerable a population.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your neighbor could be that person that, you know, one paycheck away from actually finding those
situations.
And, then the seniors.
And if you don't mm-hmm. help, mm-hmm. if you don't have any compassion for returning vets or for old people or whatever, if you don't help the young generation, what will become of those children? They will become
homeless.
The cycle repeats tomorrow's
itself,
criminals,
right?
tomorrow's drug addicts. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you're creating a whole new... you're condemning them and at the same time creating more problems down the road for society.
Yeah, more financial cost as well as human cost.
Well, and I mean, I'm just going to rattle off a couple of these things because this is obviously a very well-respected and looked up to organization. You know, you got AT&T Pioneers here, Athletes First, Bank of the West, California Bank and Trust, Cathay Bank, Chick-fil-A, Come America, you know, there's a whole bunch of financial institutions that are involved in Hitachi, mm-hmm. Mazda, Morgan Stanley, Opus Bank, Starbucks, Taco Bell, Target, Union Bank, U.S. Bank, Wells
Fargo. And
do
these people give you grants?
And these are just corporate
yeah,
volunteers.
Right.
Then you got community volunteers, you know, American Career College, Berkeley City College, Cal State Fullerton, Cal State Santa Clara. I love the fact there's all these Cal States that are involved. San Bernardino, mm-hmm. Long Beach, Chapman University, Santa Clara University, University of Southern California.
Yes.
You know,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you know.
How involved are these corporate partners? Do they just write, I mean, glad they write a check, but do they actually come down and, you know, some of these groups build
question.
Housing and get involved and or mentorship or sharing the information with their employees, sharing the scope of the problem? I mean, I know they want to do it for good, it makes them feel good and it looks good and it's great that they write checks, but do they do more than that?
It's intimately integrated. In fact, we have a financial literacy program with the banks. So the banks come out, they send their employees, and they teach the population how to manage banking, how
wow,
to save.
Perfect.
And even match funds. If you put away $25 a month for 6 months, we'll match that money for
oh,
you.
Oh, wow.
Very
see,
integrated.
Yeah,
see, the nice thing about our agency is there's unlimited opportunities to come out. And HR departments come out, and they actually teach people how to interview.
Mm-hmm.
The HR, and we have a program called Adopt Our Centers, and we just started this year. And there's seven different banks who have adopted centers, made them theirs, and their employees come in for, we just did a big spring cleaning with Deloitte, and they came in and spent mm-hmm. the whole day cleaning the center, working with the kids.
That's fabulous.
It is very integrated. It's really remarkable.
Well, I think to what we were saying is that also takes you away from being sort of not necessarily in a perch, but at
yes.
arm's distance.
Yes.
And now you're actually in there. I was on the board of Rebuilding Together Orange County and involved in that. That's the vulnerable population we have. It wasn't so much children, but it was seniors, it was veterans, it was low income, you know. And there's no barrier when you actually show up and do exactly that, when you engage and connect with that person that
yeah,
you are
makes
helping.
It real.
It
oh,
makes
right.
it real. It's
right.
no longer something I'm reading on, you know, on the internet or the news blast comes on my phone or something. How do people find you? I gave the website, but if you'll give it again, Kathy, and then how can people be involved with you guys?
We are open to all kinds of volunteers on all different levels. We're actually having a big, our annual Keys to Success, where we're honoring Mazda Foundation for their giving not only to us, but in the community in September. We're looking for people who want to help us put that together or donate auction items, that kind of thing. Just call us. Our website is www.project-access.org. And we'll hook you up with all kinds of opportunities. We have a whole volunteer department, and so please join us. It's a great outreach.
And we'll look for this if you didn't, you know, if you're listening to this after the fact, just check the website. It's full of information. I mean, great job on the website. I was looking at it earlier yeah. today. It was like, wow.
It's pretty overwhelming.
It's very overwhelming. And this is a very substantial nonprofit that's doing a lot of good work in communities mm-hmm. and very important work. So I appreciate you being here, Kathy.
Yeah. Can I throw in one
sure.
more shout-out to our founders, Affordable Housing Associates, AHA, which is a fantastic nonprofit that really conceived of us and said, hey, we need to get experts getting out there doing the social service delivery. And so we're grateful to them, too. But thank you for your support.
No, my pleasure. And I think that human component is so critical for mm-hmm. the success of something like this in a sustainable way.
Yeah.
So I appreciate you being here. Anybody has any questions, you can reach me at Rod, R-A-A-D, period, Gantus, G-H-A-N-T-O-U-S, at gmail.com, or you can call me at 949-212-8299. And thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next week.
You have been listening to the Rad Life Radio Show with your host and age explorer, Rad Gantos, brought to you on the one and only OCTalkRadio.net. Join us again next week as we continue our journey of discovery into life's challenges, opportunities, options, and all the latest and greatest things that come with getting older.